So, welcome to week two of the Battlefields of Israel. And letting a few more people in from the waiting room, I posted the link for the source sheet in the chat. And we're good. Once again, a reminder, if you didn't already register, please do register. You get the follow-up emails that way, and you get the email in advance with the materials. If you didn't pay yet, there's a link in the email as well for that. Also a reminder, our June series is planned, the Giants of Sephardic Jewry, and that'll be a four-parter in June. I hope to have a flyer out for you sometime in the next week or so, and that'll be a free series, as is our June tradition. So hopefully we'll get a nice crowd for that. Also, thank you to those who have been participating in my Beit Midrash's Shavuaton, our week of programming, lessons in reinvention from Rabbi Akiva, we had our Sunday, Monday, Tuesday programs, but we still have Wednesday and Thursday evening, as well as a concert and class on Friday, Lag BaOmer, and, the flyer for that will be in the email, in the follow-up email that I send out after class later today. So, last week we started by introducing the concept of learning about battlefields and studying battlefields and what exactly that's about for us as Jews. And we talked about how you learn about the battlefield, first of all, as a reminder of what went on. And that's the villainy, the heroism, all the different aspects of what happened within the battle. Then we learn about the battlefield itself with its physical features, which carries its own meaning in Judaism. And then further, a third layer, the miracles that occur in each of these biblical battles, because they are biblical battles, and therefore there will be miracles to be discussed. And we started with the story of Jericho, or in Hebrew, Yericho, and learned the story itself from Joshua chapter 6. This is the first battle the Jews have when they enter into the land. It is indeed a battle of full destruction, as I mentioned last week, and as a few people noted. This raises all sorts of questions from an ethical, moral perspective, but it's way beyond what we can do in this series. And I gave you the link last week on the source sheet, and I put it again at the top of this week's source sheet for the 2014 series that we had about war. Not that the classes that we did back then resolve all problems and answer all questions and make us feel good, but at least it gives us some food for thought from the sources about how we deal with what should be a troubling issue. But what we focused on last time was the story itself, of the Jews going around the city seven times over 7 days, blowing the shofar, led by the priests, and how on day seven the walls, as they say, come tumbling down, and the city is indeed destroyed, never to be rebuilt, and the Jews are told not to take any of the spoils. Okay, all of this hopefully is familiar. Wait, remember it from 1 week to the next? Totally do. So that brings us to the battlefield itself, the walled city, as well as the collapse of the wall and what we're supposed to take from that. And then we'll move into our next battlefield, which is Ayalon, which is a very different circumstance. All right. As always, I've muted everybody by default, but you are free to please unmute to ask questions, make comments. I much prefer if people do that aloud as opposed to writing it in the chat. Okay, so with the review behind us, let's move forward. The walled city, this idea of a walled city. What does the walled character of a city say to you when you hear that a city has a wall, biblically? What does that image mean?
Stay away.
Okay. I mean, that's certainly the message for the outsider, is stay away.
It means protection.
Means protection, right? I'm sorry, Myrna, what?
For the inhabitants.
Protection for the inhabitants, absolutely. A walled city is a fortress. right? That's the idea of a walled city. That's why you build a wall. If you take a look at source number one, I guess it's also a good infrastructure project. It gives people jobs and so forth. Let's not forget that. But take a look at source number one. This is from the book of Bamidbar, of Numbers. The Jews are in the wilderness. They're camped out at Sinai for a year after they receive the Torah, and then they're told it's time to enter Israel. And they decide, in their trap, like to send in spies. They want a sense of what this land is going to be like. And we know that story, of course, is disastrous in the end. The spies come back, warning them that people there are too powerful, we can't possibly manage, and so forth. But what we're looking at in source number one, in the first part of it, is part of the instructions they gave to the spies. What is it that we want to see as we enter this land? What is it that we're supposed to be looking for, is what the spies want to know. And take a look at source number one. And what is the land in which they dwell? Is it good or bad? Okay. And what are the cities in which they dwell? Are they in open camps or are they in fortresses? I just put the link again in the chat for the source sheet for anyone who doesn't have it. What are the cities in which they dwell? Are they in open camps or in fortresses? The word in Hebrew for fortress there is mivtzarim. It's a fortress, an area in which they are protected by having a wall outside. So that's one of the chief questions that they put to the spies. Are the people there living in fortresses? Now, what's the message to you again? When they're living in a fortress, it means that, we said that it means that they are protected, right? What else could it mean? Number one, yes, you have a wall, and the wall is protective. And number two, it might also tell you that the inhabitants are scared, right? There's a reason why you build those walls. Those who build walls tend to be afraid of that which is beyond the walls. And that's a big discussion in its own right. Take a look still in source number one. The second half of source number one. This is when the spies come back. And look at what they have to say. First, they describe that the land is wonderful. The land is great. And then they write, or the Torah writes here, I'm just going to start my other Zoom on my phone because it looks like my connection is still poor. Four, there's a lot of fear surrounding that. But there's another element to a walled city besides being a fortress. What else is there besides being a fortress?
Keeping people out.
Keeping people out? That's part of a fortress, I would think. But what else?
Wealth. The city's big.
Wealth, I heard?
Keep people in.
Keep people in. City, state.
I would have thought that they have experience already with war because people who are living in a free, open city, they feel secure. That people who feel they have to build walls around themselves are people who have experience with being attacked.
Right, that's fair.
They also know one another, and they're very comfortable with one another.
Well, one would hope so. If you're stuck in a walled city together, we'd hope that you'd get along. What I'm looking for, in addition to all of that, is permanence. Right? An open area in which people live, but there's no wall. You can sprawl, you can spread, this part is developed, this part is left undeveloped. When you're talking about a walled city, there is a permanence to it. And there's a very interesting application of that in the Torah. The Torah talks about a situation in which somebody's fortunes decline. A person was doing well financially, and then their fortunes decline. And as a result of the decline in their fortunes, they need to sell off their property. So that may be that they have to sell off an ancestral field, and it may be that they have to sell off their home, perhaps their home in a walled city. So the rule, if they sell off their field, is that they can buy it back 2 years later. They have to give the buyer a couple of years to have it, because otherwise that's not good, that's not fair. But 2 years later they can buy it back at the basic price that they sold it for. There's more to it, but I don't want to get distracted by it. What I want to show you is the rule for when you sell a house in a walled city. Take a look at source number two. And when one sells a house of dwelling in a walled city, its redemption shall be until the end of the year of its sale. For a year shall be its redemption. You have 1 year to redeem your house. What redeeming means is that you go to the person who bought it off you, you say, here's your money back. Straight up, I'm going to give you what you gave me, and now you have no choice but to return the keys. That's the way it works. And if it is not redeemed until a complete year has fully passed, the house in the walled city will stand permanently for the one who purchased it for his generations. It never goes back. Meaning?
Not even in the Jubilee year?
Not even in the Jubilee year, exactly. That's what the text says. The Jubilee year, how many years is it between Jubilee years? Not 7. 50. 50. It's 49 years, and then year 50 is the Jubilee year. There's the Shemitah year, the sabbatical year that's every 7. The Jubilee year, in Hebrew is the Yovel, is every 50.
So technically it's not sold.
It is sold.
Well, technically, but it's always there, and you can always buy it back.
No, that's what we're saying, is you can't. Your field you can always buy back. Your house, only up to a year. And then after that, it's gone. Whereas if you're dealing with a field, if you sell off a field, it's an ancestral plot, it comes back to the family in the Jubilee year. Whether the Jubilee year is 5 years from the time of sale, or whether it's 30 years from the time of sale, doesn't matter. It always comes back. A field always comes back. That's where Marilyn is right. The field hasn't really been sold, it's been rented out. The house, it's gone. After a year, you didn't redeem it, it's gone. As opposed to if it's in an open city. The text continues in number two. The houses of villages which have no wall around them shall be considered as fields of the land. It may be redeemed. And in the Jubilee year, it will revert. If it's an open city, you could buy it back. You get it back automatically in the Yovel, in the Jubilee year. By the way, this is the Torah portion, not this coming Shabbat, but the following week. The Parsha of Bahar. So, what we draw from here is that walled cities have stability. They have permanence. So, those are the two elements. They're fortresses, and they're permanent. And the message here, then, in terms of understanding what we're supposed to take away from this, and take away from the battle in Jericho, is that the Canaanites are fearsome, they have developed a permanence in the land, and here's the key, the war you are fighting is not really about a city. The war you are fighting is about the land itself. It's about the identity of the land that they hold. And that becomes very important as we transition to talk about the collapse of the wall. Take a look. Oh, you don't have it because I didn't bring it again. It was in last week's sheet. The text said in Joshua chapter 6 that we saw last week that the wall fell beneath itself. The rabbis understood what that means is not that the wall collapsed, but that it sank into the ground. Straight down. The wall is as though it had never been there. What's the message of that kind of miracle? What's the message in that?
That they're ready to expand, that they're ready to receive new people, that the community's going to change.
Well, receiving new people, I mean, Jericho is, as we had said, destroyed. And you're not allowed to build it up again. So I'm not so sure about receiving new people. Okay, yes, I would agree with that. What else?
It's very vulnerable.
I think it's giving a message that goes two ways. It's a message to the Jews who are coming in, and it's also a message to the Canaanites. To the Jews, it says, don't be intimidated by these walled cities. You were so scared in source number one. Though no, they have fortresses. Don't worry about the fortresses. They're going to get crushed. They can't do anything. And don't worry about their permanence either, because they're not permanent. That which identified them as permanent has disappeared. And it's a message to the Canaanites, don't think your walls are going to defend you. That's what I see here. But more than that, it goes back to what we said last week about Jericho, right? We said that Jericho is a city which is devoted to immorality as presented. Number one, we compared it to other Canaanite cities that we knew about, the city of Sodom as an example. But number two, we talked about that woman, Rahab, being pressed into service as a zonah at the age of 10. And her clientele are the leadership of the city. That's the personality that we're given for this city. And so what we're told now is that this land is being rebranded. All that was built up in that city is being demolished as though it had never been there. And now I come back to one of the things we noted last week. How many times do they go around the city?
Seven.
Seven times, right? We said they go around seven times for 7 days, right? We even had the idea that the seventh day, the day of the war, may have been Shabbat, right? 7 days like 7 days of
creation.
This is a new process of creation. This is a new process of what we call in Hebrew, Bereshit. The world is starting again, effectively. As you come into the land, and as you fight this initial battle, you're actually recreating the land itself. But more than that, they're told not to take the spoils. So we said last week there are a few reasons why not to take the spoils, right? You want to show that this isn't a war of enrichment, this isn't something we're doing for ourselves, and I think that's important. But it's also because if you take the spoils, then what you're doing really is transferring the identity of the old city to the new one, right? You're taking the old city and now making it part of yourself. By saying we leave the spoils untouched and we never build up the city again, you're saying what was there is old and is not going to be part of the new world. You follow? I have more on that, but I see Mickey's hand. Go ahead, Mickey.
Wasn't it also just a way of taxation?
What do you mean?
Traveling for 40 years and equipping an army, the treasury was low. So they issued an edict that whatever spoils there are in this city, which is one of the oldest cities in the world, it comes to the government.
But the government didn't get it. If the government took it, I would agree with you. But what we were told was only that the tabernacle, this Mishkan that the Jews had, got the vessels that you could use to serve in the Mishkan, and everything else was to be destroyed. They didn't...
But it was the same thing, because the municipal and civic leadership was the priests. So they were wearing two hats, and they're saying it all comes in the west door into the tabernacle, and we are available to spend it on the east door, because we're the leadership.
But they only got the vessels that would actually be used for temple service. They didn't get all of the wealth of it. They didn't get any money. They didn't get any animals. If I were trying to design what you describe, if I wanted to design a system in which the temple would be enriched by it, then I would have said, take all the animals. I would have said, take all the gold and silver, but they deliberately don't. They only get vessels they can use in the service. It was what we read last week in Joshua 6. I didn't bring you the text again on there, but I will tell you it is...
It's Joshua 6, 21, 25. It's number 15. Sorry, I have the sheet from last week.
Oh, thank you. Excellent. Thank you, Rosalind.
Where was the temple?
The temple, so it's a traveling one at that point. It's a Mishkan, and it's in a
Mishkan.
Place... It's in a place called Gilgal, which was where they crossed the Jordan River. Eti, you were going to say?
Yeah, I have a problem with this. Why they destroyed the city? I thought they came to inhabit the land.
Exactly.
You said never to rebuild.
Correct. This city is meant to be, unlike any other war they would fight, this city is meant to represent that the land is being rebranded. You're not going to live there. You're not going to build it up. It's counterintuitive. I would have expected, move in. It's a great walled city. And what they're told is don't move in. This city is meant to represent the change coming to the land. That's exactly the point. But I'll go even further. Take a look on your sheet at source number 3. This tells a story that happened later on in Tanakh. Much later on, actually. Centuries and centuries later. This is in the time of the prophet Eliyahu, Elijah. You're now, give or take, 500 years after that war with Jericho. Give or take a century. So, at this point, the Jews have split into two kingdoms. There is a southern kingdom and a northern kingdom. The southern kingdom was known as Judea. The northern kingdom was known as Israel, Yisrael. The southern kingdom had Jerusalem and tended overall to be much more traditional, much more focused on Judaism as it had been practiced. The northern kingdom, on the other hand, veers into idolatry. And they have kings who actually make that their mission. And one of those kings is a man by the name of Ahav, or in Hebrew, in English, you would call him Ahab.
Did you say the north was Israel?
Correct. That was what was called Yisrael. Correct. So take a look at source number 3. And Ahav made, this is describing his activities. Ahav made the Asherah. Anybody know what an Asherah is?
An idol.
So it is idol related, correct? It's some form of tree worship.
Isn't it Astarte?
So Astarte is actually different. A lot of people connect the two. But the Astarte was called Ashtarot in Hebrew. And Asherah is actually separate. The Asherah was tree worship, in which either they would worship the tree itself or an idol that was at the base of the tree. There's some dispute about that. But Ahav makes the Asherah, and Ahav added acts to anger Hashem, to anger God, Hashem, God of Israel, beyond those of the previous kings of Israel. He's an overachiever. In his days, Chiel of Beit El built up Jericho. With his firstborn, Abiram, he established her foundation, and with his youngest, Seguv, he set up her doors, as per the word of God spoken by Joshua, son of Nun. In other words, what this is trying to tell us is that the curse that was stated last week at the end of chapter 6, whoever builds it up is going to lose his children along the way, actually happened with this fellow Chiel, who builds it up under the direction of King Ahav. So, Ian, I see your hand. Hang in there for a minute. With such a terrible price, why in the world does Ahav insist on this? You have to know who Ahav is. Ahav's goal is to reverse their entry into the land. The Jews came into Canaan and converted it into the land of Israel. He wants to reverse that. Ahav married who? What was the name of Ahav's wife?
Jezebel.
Jezebel, correct. You know who her parents were? Her father was Et Baal, king of the Tzidonim, a tribe that lived in the area, not Jewish. That's how you have to know that going in. Ahav and Jezebel are worshippers of the Baal, one of the Canaanite, or the main Canaanite god, perhaps. Throughout their career, we see them trying to roll back the presence of the Jewish God in the land. Elijah has a whole back and forth, not for our discussion right now. But the point is that Ahav sees this as a coup. He wants to roll back the conquest of Jericho and erase the memory of it. And that's his goal. So that's why he wants to build up the city. Ian, thank you for waiting. He was not trying to eliminate it. No, Achav. I mean, Achav is a very interesting person because sometimes he seems good and sometimes he seems awful. There's a lot to be said about Achav beyond, you know, beyond the scope of where we are here. But he did not battle idolatry, no.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So what I have for you, oh, Mark, yes.
Just going back to the spoils. God never commanded that. It was Joshua's idea. God never said
correct. No, that's, I mean, that was part of our discussion last week as to whether that was so. But yes, that's, that does seem to be so. That was the discussion that we had.
Okay.
Yeah. We talked about why and so on. Okay. So I gave you review questions on the sheet. Which I'll just run through very quickly. First of all, what was the goal of destroying Jericho? So we said it was replacing immorality. That's the idea. How many days did the war with Jericho take? Seven. Yeah. Good. Thanks, Rose. How many priests carried shofar horns? We said seven. How many circuits did the priests make around the city?
Seven.
And then, which of these is not a characteristic of walled cities in the Torah? Security, permanence, agriculture.
Agriculture.
Right.
Agriculture.
Good. I originally had set this up as a poll on Zoom, with the multiple choice and everything, but it would take too much time, so I'm just doing it this way. Which of these is the message of the miraculous collapse of Jericho's walls? Rebranding Israel? Time to build a casino? Or walls are prohibited around Israeli cities?
One.
Number one, correct. There's actually a lot of discussion about walls in Israeli cities. Jerusalem, of course, being a walled city. There's more to be said about walls, but that'll have to be for another time. Oh, nothing. It was just to mislead you. Jericho had the Oasis Hotel and Casino. Yeah, but that's a longer discussion also. Okay,